The name for this study is Paul's Teaching of Sanctification, Romans 6 through 8. We're going to begin jumping right into Romans 6, and that's always a dangerous thing to do because there are five chapters worth of information that precedes that will probably have somewhat to do with our understanding of chapters 6, 7, 8 that we're going to be looking at. However, there is a significant shift of focus between chapters 5 and 6, not in the sense that they're not connected, but a shift in focus because he has been dealing with the information that's necessary for us to understand the concept of being justified before God on the basis of somebody else's behavior and activity. And in some ways, that lays the foundation then for our understanding of how we are to walk, but there are some things that need to be clarified. And as we go through our studies in chapters 6 through 8, if and when we see things that need to be clarified from prior information, which we will be doing this evening, we will go back to those so that we're not really just hanging out there in the wind. But as we begin to look at this study, Paul began this section of Romans with a question that he really repeats again. Chapter 6 can actually be divided into two sections. One of them, starting in verse 1, says, "What shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin that grace might increase?" And, of course, the answer is no. But then in verse 15, he says, "What then? Shall we sin because we're not under law but under grace?" And then, again, the answer is no. So there are two big issues in the chapter, and the first one has to do with something that he had already mentioned. So what we're going to be doing is looking at the things that he had mentioned in chapter 5 that would even raise this question, because he asks a question that is on the surface of it, frankly, ridiculous. Are we to continue in sin so grace might increase? He says that we shouldn't, that we who have died to sin shouldn't live in it any longer, verse 2 at the end. And that implies that continuing in sin does mean to continue to sin. And no thinking Christian is ever going to think that that's even, I mean, it's a ridiculous question. Nobody who believes in Christ is going to feel comfortable with the idea that how we live is immaterial. We can continue to sin and continue to do sins. So, I think the first question that we really have to ask is, why would Paul even go there? So that's where we're headed this evening. Why does he say, "What shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin that grace might increase?" I think the way we understand that depends on whether we understand why he would even raise that question. And there has to be a reason or he wouldn't have raised it. So, one of the issues that I'm going to address first is the cruciality of the question. Because when he starts, he actually asks two questions in verse 1. What shall we say then? And then, are we to continue in sin that grace might increase? And the issue of what shall we say then is a really interesting formula because it shows up a lot of, well, Paul uses the word that's translated say here 11 times in Romans, and 9 of those 11, he is calling for some kind of a conclusion to information that's already been set forth, or in a sense challenging a conclusion that somebody has raised or is going to draw that's not right. And in this case, that's what he's doing. He's saying, is this conclusion that we should continue in sin so grace might increase, is that legitimate? Is that what we should say? And the interesting thing about these 9 of these 11 uses of this particular word in Romans is that it almost invariably is in a context where the issue is that you're going to draw a doctrinal conclusion. And the issue is not what shall we say, but what shall we conclude. So he's asking for a conclusion to be drawn. And it's a conclusion to be drawn on the basis of doctrine that's already been established, and the resulting conclusion that's drawn will then become a part of the doctrinal formulation of truth by which we are going to live. And therefore, the question is crucial, because whatever we conclude is going to become a part of the way we see life in terms of its function and identity, or identity and function. In other words, the conclusion we draw is going to be a part of our doctrinal commitment, and our doctrine is what guides our choices and so forth, because if we believe something, it will inform our choices. It will say, choose this and not that, or do this and not that, because everything is driven by that love-faith complex that is always at work. And because Paul is using the term or the sentence, what shall we then say, or what shall we conclude from this, in verse 1 of chapter 6, because he's doing that, he's actually drawing or calling for a fairly critical doctrinal conclusion. And the doctrinal conclusion that he's raising is, what is our attitude about sinning? What should we conclude from what he's told us in chapter 5? And that's crucial, because how we answer it will dictate then how we go about living from here forward. So, I think it's crucial for us to stop and ask ourselves, do we as Christians honestly think in any sense that it's okay to continue in sin? So that even if there is a legitimacy to the idea that it will cause grace to increase? There's a parallel to this idea back in chapter 3, because in chapter 3, Paul laid out some things, and he said in verse 5, if our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, what shall we conclude? The God who inflicts wrath is not unrighteous, is he? I'm speaking in terms of men. In other words, God inflicting wrath on people who are sinful by the way they've been twisted after creation actually makes the righteousness of God more obviously clear, so God's getting a good out of it. So is it wrong for him to then judge the people who are actually providing the background for the demonstration of his righteousness? And then he says, verse 8, why not? As we are slanderously reported, and as some affirm, we say, let's do evil that good may come. Why not that? Well, that's a parallel concept, the idea that we might conclude that God actually has a good reason for us sinning, and the good reason for us sinning is therefore a justification for our attitude toward it. And the question that I'm raising is, do believers ever, with a real clear conscience, really think that it's okay to sin just because there's going to be good that God's going to work out of it? And in verse 1 of chapter 6, the idea is that grace will increase. So grace needs to have a pursuit of sin in order to increase. Grace needs that. So where did this come from? Where does this idea that we as believers are possibly to settle into a relatively easy acceptance of sin, both as a root and a fruit? Because it's patently ludicrous, but nonetheless, there are an awful lot of people who sort of have already decided that. It comes in the form of kind of, well, you know, if I just get to heaven, I'll be happy. They don't have any interest in any kind of inheritance or any kind of advantage because of a life of learned truth and believing in this world might provide for them. The glory that's to be revealed is just dismissed because it's really not all that important. If I just get in the gate, I'll be a happy person. Well, there's truth to that. The thief on the cross got in by the skin of his teeth, and I'm sure he's a happy person. So there is some truth to that, but generally that expression is an expression of an attitude of carelessness toward the issue of sin and kind of saying, well, it's really not all that important. But one of the questions we have to ask and answer in relation to that idea of continuing to sin so that some good will come would be this. What is the point of a salvation that doesn't save us? Salvation is not just a deliverance from the wrath of God. That is a valid concept of salvation, but it's not just that. The idea of salvation from the wrath of God is a valid preliminary point, but it's not a concept of salvation that is comprehensive. It's a very incomplete one. If my concept of salvation basically boils down to a fire escape, which is deliverance from the wrath to come, well, then my whole concept of salvation has been reduced to one little thing that basically is an escapist position. And it really reduces all of the benefits of conversion to those benefits which, as I've already mentioned, the thief on the cross got. Nothing more. The thief on the cross didn't get right with God until he was hanging on the cross and he was going to die within two or three hours of the comments that he made, because the soldiers were going to come along and break his legs so that he could no longer push himself up to get a breath and he would suffocate. That was going to happen to him. Whether he knew they were going to do that or not is quite beside the point. But the point is, when he said to Jesus, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom," and Jesus said, "Today you will be with me in paradise," he gave the thief on the cross what I would just call the basic salvation package, the very minimal issue. You get in the door. But that means then that the whole issue of benefits to conversion have been reduced now to simply being present in paradise. Nothing more than that. But what that actually does is it reduces all of the whole New Testament in all of its teaching and all of its exhortation, except for the parts that are decidedly evangelistic, trying to get an unbeliever to come to faith. All of the rest of it is ineffectual and, in effect, deceitful. Because the whole concept of salvation being merely to get in the door just eliminates the need for the whole New Testament. You don't need much of anything that Paul wrote. You don't need the book of Hebrews. You don't need James. You don't need Peter's writings. You don't need John's letters. You don't need the prophecies of the book of Revelation. Because all of those books were written to motivate believers to increase, as we studied in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, and develop and grow for an inheritance that is waiting for them. And the idea that salvation is just an escape from the wrath of God just eliminates all of that. So, Paul's doctrine of salvation, it's really just drawn down to one issue by the idea that it's okay, just accept the reality of our sinfulness as a root and a fruit and don't worry about it. Grace will increase. But then also Paul's doctrine of being in sin, of remaining in sin. To continue in sin, that's an issue of a state of being, whereas living in sin in terms of being behaving, that doing sins, that's the outworking of the condition. So remaining in this condition is Paul's way of talking about a situation where sin is dominant. And his concept of being in sin in chapters 1 through 5 is not a concept of an occasional fault of otherwise okay people. Paul's doctrine of sin is a doctrine of being enslaved to sin so that no righteousness can result. Jesus said on one occasion, "Either make the tree good and the fruit good, because a corrupt tree cannot produce good fruit." And Paul's concept of men in sin is developed in chapter 3, where he point blankly says, there's none good, not even one. And then he goes through a whole litany of things describing their condition in sin, and there is no righteousness that comes out of it. None. A lot of people think, you know, if I stand before God, He's going to compare my good stuff with my bad. Well, outside of Jesus Christ, that's no comparison because there's nothing good there. It's all bad. So, the big question then is, what would be the point of the New Testament? Instruction with godliness as a goal. If believers are just to continue in sin, so grace might increase. They're just to settle into an easy acceptance of the reality of sin and its root, being a root, and the sins that are its fruit. So we're looking for a rationale. Why would Paul ask this question? Well, it has to be pertinent, or Paul would have never raised it. He never raised an impertinent issue. He didn't ever say anything that didn't need to be said. So somewhere, something that Paul said, he's assuming, might be twisted into a concept where believers can remain or persist in the condition of sin so that this good thing called grace increasing might result. So we're going to look for why that might have come to pass. And I think the first part of it is back in chapter 5, verse 19. In chapter 5, verse 19, he said, "For as through the one man's disobedience the many were made sinners, even so through the obedience of the one, the many will be made righteous." Now, in this text, where Paul twice uses a verb that's translated "were made," it means to set somebody or something into a position of function for which that someone or something has been effectively qualified. It's illustrated in Matthew 24:45, where Jesus says, "Who is that good and faithful servant to whom the Lord will commit the functions of his kingdom?" Well, the whole idea of a person being qualified before God commits anything to him is the idea of a developing reality. Something has been done here. And in verse 19, that verb basically means that through the sin of one man, the disobedience of one man, in effect, all of his offspring were made, they were constituted, they were set up to be sinners. And that means that that's all they can do, sin. And that was his argument all the way. I mean, even back here in chapter 3. He's just point blankly after chapters 1 and 2. He says in verse 9 of chapter 3, "What then, are we better than they?" No. We've already charged both Jews and Greeks. They're all under sin. And then he goes through a whole litany of quotations from the Old Testament to prove that man outside of Christ is hopelessly wicked. Sinful. So when he says in verse 19 of chapter 5 that Adam, by one act, constituted all of his progeny as sinners, he is, in effect, saying, Adam made them this way. Adam, by his disobedience, did something that caused all of his offspring to be constituted sinners. And I'm not real sure how that works. I mean, it's clear in Romans 5 that Paul is teaching a doctrine of headship over a whole race so that Adam's offspring were in his loins when he sinned, so they all get credit for having done that. But getting credit for having done it doesn't explain how his behavior forces their behavior. But that's what he's teaching. There was something in the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil that altered Adam's basic physical makeup. I think it was some kind of a genetic poison, but it set up his DNA and his genetics so that all of his offspring then were under the curse of death because he started to die as soon as he ate. That poison set in. But something also happened that I don't know if anybody can really explain, but the fact is, from then on, every offspring of Adam was compelled to sin by his own nature. He was a constituted sinner, and now he's compelled to sin. There's nothing he can do about that compulsion. And, of course, we've argued in the past that the virgin birth was necessary because that compulsion comes through the man and not the woman. But, having said that, he says in verse 19, through the one man's disobedience, the many were constituted sinners. But then he turns right around and says, even so, through the obedience of the one, the many will be constituted righteous. So you got to be consistent here. I mean, if Adam's sin makes his offspring sin, they compel to sin because he constituted them sinners, then it stands to reason that through Christ's obedience, something happens to those who become his offspring in the sense of a new race, the new birth offspring. They are constituted righteous, so they can only do righteousness. Okay? Now, most of us will gag at that, stumble over it big time, because one of two things will happen. We'll either say, well, then I'm not a believer, because I don't always do what's right, or we'll say something else. And that something else is part of my argument here. Adam's action effectively qualified, constituted his progeny as sinners, and Christ's action also effectively qualified his offspring through the new birth as righteous. And that declaration of itself would render Paul's question ridiculous in verse 1 of chapter 6, because if you're constituted righteous, you can't keep on sinning. It's impossible to sin if you're not a sinner. Sin comes from being constituted a sinner. So if you're constituted a righteous person by Christ, then you can't sin anymore. So the question is ridiculous. So obviously there's a problem here. So the question then is, what's the solution to the problem? Well, some people are going to go to verse 19 and say, well, look, wait a minute. There's a change in tense between Adam and his were made. The one disobedience, the many were made. That's an aorist. Has to do with something that happened in the past. But it also says, through the obedience, the many shall be made. That's a future tense. Okay, so now we can say, okay, wait a minute. Adam's constituted all of his offspring as sinners, and that's a past fact, and it's an undeniable fact. We don't even have to try to sin as the offspring of Adam. It just comes as natural as breathing. In fact, breathing is a part of our inheritance from Adam, so it's just as natural as breathing to sin. And since none of us find the perfection of total righteous behavior as natural as breathing, we have to say, okay, he said it will happen. It shall be. They shall be made. So that means it hadn't been done yet. Which would throw it into the future. And, of course, our understanding of the mortal putting on immortality, the rapture, the transformation, that's what we look forward to, because it is part of our hope that at that point we won't sin anymore and we'll do righteousness as natural as breathing. So in a sense, our theology has always been, well, there is this declaration, but the full realization of it is not till the future. I mean, that's how some people would approach verse 19, and I think that's the first part of how we get misled. Paul used the future tense, and that implies that there's an action that's only going to be realized in the future. But the question is, to what degree? So the second part that might mislead us is verse 21. Well, verse 20 actually says, the law came in that the transgression might increase, but where sin increased, grace abounded all the more. And so that's the issue in verse 1. Shall we continue in sin that grace might increase all the more? Well, part of the confusion is in verse 21, because he says, as sin reigned in death, even so grace might reign through righteousness to eternal life through Jesus Christ. So sin brought about death, but grace reigns through righteousness to life. And again, sin's rule in death is and was absolute. He even said in verse 13 of chapter 5, until the law, sin was in the world, but sin's not imputed when there's no law. There, nevertheless, death reigned. So death reigned over Adam's progeny because they're sinners. Even if there was no law to define exactly what they were doing wrong, what they were doing was sin. Just because the law hadn't defined it didn't mean it wasn't sinful. It just means the definitions that weren't out there. You couldn't tell what was sin, what wasn't, because you didn't have a background or a backdrop against which to measure it. But the fact is, they were constituted sinners, so that's all they could do. And the law simply stepped into the place and started saying, okay, that was a sin, 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 that was a sin. And you end up with this idea that constituted sinners just sin all the time. They just don't know it until somebody comes along and says, that was a sin. And that was the function of law. Law didn't actually make people do more sins. It just identified the ones they were doing so that it exploded in terms of their understanding of their behavior is wrong. So, if sin's rule in death was and is absolute, in the sense that if you're in sin, death is going to happen, we might think then that the rule of grace through righteousness should also be absolute, just like in verse 19, because it's kind of an absolutist concept. Sin reigned in death, grace might reign through righteousness to life. And in this concept, he didn't switch to the future, but he did move to the subjunctive. Sin reigned in death is just a fact. But he says, even so, grace might or should reign through righteousness to eternal life. And since he moved it into the subjunctive, he's talking about potential. That's the best. He's talking about it might or ought to be this way. And that opens the door to the possibility that sin's rule was absolute, but grace's rule at this point is not. There is the potential for grace to provide righteousness because it reigns through righteousness to life. That's a potential, but it's not a declaration of a realized reality. So I think those two texts, verse 19 and 21, do raise this issue. What shall we conclude then? Shall we conclude that the salvation that God has promised us is entirely futuristic? There's really no transformation of the human being. You know, we're offspring of Adam, and even though our conversion to Christ has brought some things good to pass, it really has not stopped us from sinning. And since it has not stopped us from sinning, then what are we supposed to conclude? Well, some of them saying what we should conclude is, it doesn't matter. Because even though it didn't stop us from sinning, in verse 20 it says, where sin increased, grace abounded. So don't worry about it. Just let grace abound. Well, in what sense does grace abound when sin's increasing? That's one of the issues. But the point is, Paul's concept, and this is the third issue where confusion might come in. We might be confused because verse 19 implies an absolutist kind of thing, but it's thrown into the future. Verse 21 implies an absolutist kind of thing, but it's moved into subjunctive potential rather than actual reality. The third thing is, Paul talks about being in sin, and his concept of bondage to sin is an absolute. And if bondage to sin is an absolute, then the dominion of grace is only potential and particularly futuristic. Why not just settle into sin and wait for the future? I mean, if bondage to sin is absolute and deliverance is only in the future, it's kind of ridiculous to struggle against the inevitable. The Christian life is a struggle against the inevitable, is what some of them are concluding from what Paul has said. And then there's another thing that can also mislead, and that is the fourth part of what Paul says that might mislead is his declaration that grace superabounds when sin abounds. If God's going to step into the picture with grace everywhere sin is expressed, that kind of implies that there's no really any long-term damage caused by sin. So why fight it? If grace is going to superabound, why not let it? So I think there are at least four things that raise this question legitimately. Because I think people do say, well, what shall we conclude to chapter 5? What doctrine should we develop from chapter 5 that is going to be the bedrock for the choices we make about our life here in this world? Is it going to be a constant struggle against sin with a little bit of perhaps eking out a little bit of righteousness along the way, a little squish here and a little squish there? But mostly it's just going to be a constant struggle against sin. What should we conclude? Why fight it? Is that what we're supposed to conclude? I mean, grace is going to superabound, so why fight it? Just let grace superabound. Well, I think the question then is pertinent for this reason. If that's what we conclude, that will determine the quality of our experience, both in time and eternity. Because we will find out that as we continue to live in this world and we are continuing to do things that are death-producing, that our experience will become more and more and more and more deadly. Our experience of death will simply just get deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper until finally we're dead, dead, dead. If we really think that what Paul was teaching in chapter 5 ought to lead us to the conclusion that we ought to just let grace superabound, don't sweat it. If we decide that, it will determine the quality of our experience. And it will do it at two levels, because it'll do it in time, because even in time, sin destroys us. And when we sin, it corrupts our experience on many levels. But also, since we're here in time as a prelude and a preparation for eternity, the judgment seat of Christ is going to reveal and establish our and fix our experience in eternity. Well, if we've decided that there's no point, I mean, Paul's doctrine is the inevitability of sin since we're still in this Adamic setting, then, and as a consequence, at the judgment seat, it'll all just go up in smoke, everything. And there goes the inheritance. So, there is another issue, and that is there another answer? Well, obviously, verse 2 starts out with, absolutely not. In other words, that is not the right conclusion. So, from this evening and on in Romans chapter 6, as we move into that, one of the things that we're going to be asking ourselves is, how do we escape? What did our salvation actually generate so that, even though it's not an absolute victory over all sin all the time, there is a potential where grace can reign to life. It can bring about the experience of life, and it can do it in a dominant way so that our lives, instead of being a downward spiral, are an upward development of experience of life. There has to be that kind of an answer, and I think that the issues of chapter 6, 7, and 8 are the issues of Paul's explaining the reality of what happened when Christ did his obedience and then transferred it to us, so that it becomes a matter of, if we get it, our experience of life will begin. In other words, if we understand Romans 6, 7, and 8, if we go with the may it never be, God forbid, verse 2, if we reject that notion that sin is just a dominant factor and there's nothing you can do about it, so just don't worry about it. God's grace will just superabound everywhere it abounds, and just don't worry about it. If we settle for that, it'll just spiral down in our experience. But if we don't settle for that, if we actually come to grips with what Paul is saying in the chapters to come, life will become an upward development. We enter into more and more and more of the quality called life, as we understand what he's saying and believe it. So I'm not going to give you the answers because they're in chapters 6, 7, and 8. But we are going to reject this answer that we can just get comfortable in the fact that sin's an inevitability and let's just don't sweat it. That's not what we should conclude.